I'm Sonny Blechinger, KBOO's Artist in Residence for 2015. Hope you'll join us at the Clinton Street Theater December 10th, Thursday night at 7 p.m. for the broadcast of my radio play, The Pool. It's about four swimmers who happen to use the same pool at the same time every week. It'll be broadcast with new video by local filmmaker Lincoln Baron Holmes and hosted by the comedians from American Comedy, Paul Schlesinger and Jason Traeger. Following the radio play will be a screening of the 1968 film The Swimmer, starring Burt Lancaster. Again, that's Thursday night, December 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the World Beat Holiday Festival featuring Ballins and Wamba Friday and Saturday, December 4th and 5th at Vida Bohem in Portland. Friday night will start off with the funky and jazzy World Beat band Wamba and late night African dance party with DJ Henry. Saturday night will feature Ballins' local Haitian Zouk band, also with DJ Henry. Again, that's the World Beat Holiday Festival featuring Ballins and Wamba Friday and Saturday, December 4th and 5th at Vida Bohem, 1530 Southeast 7th Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The music playing is Interstellar Dub by DJ Mad from Portland's label Zam Zam Sounds. I'm Andre Middleton, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland, Oregon. I'll be hosting Art Focus on Tuesday mornings from 11:30 to noon on a bi-weekly basis, alternating with Joseph Galvan. Thank you for joining us. Today, my guests are Ezra Erickson and Tracy Harrison of Zam Zam Sounds. Assalamu alaikum to you both.
Alaikum assalam.
Thank you guys for joining us today. So let's just get right into it. I've known you guys for a while, so we're gonna. This is gonna be just a fun conversation. So, to educate me and our audience, what is Zam Zam Sounds and what was its genesis?
Oh man, well, how far back do you want us to go? I guess.
Well, when did the name Zam Zam come into your lexicon?
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's going further back than the label, but we can get into that too. The label we started 3.5 years ago now. After a pretty long hiatus from releasing music, we had a label called BSI Records with a couple partners back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And when the music industry kind of imploded, some distributors went under, taking us with them, basically. So, right. You know, we never stopped loving music. We never stopped buying records. I never stopped DJing. Tracy DJs too. But it took a lot of years to kind of emotionally and financially recover from that. And honestly, we didn't think we would get back into it, but it just started to feel like it was time and we just wanted to start putting music out again. So we tested the waters with a 7-inch and it did well. So we did another and, you know, it looked viable. So we just kept going.
But we started the record label, this recent one, Zam Zam Sounds, with the notion that it was going to be a smaller, more focused project overall, and not have the kind of, broader spectrum in terms of different releases, different genres, different formats. We knew that we wanted to make something that was super focused and only 7-inch every time with those structures and limitations in place at the outset.
Right. Now, what is the community around the music genre that you guys specialize in?
So, I guess it's broadly dub and reggae oriented music, with a real sound system focus. And so, what we mean by that is there's kind of a global sound system culture, music that is really made for hand built sound systems. So, the way the music is mixed, even though there's a really broad spectrum of music that we release and that kind of goes by, you know, this catch-all of sound system music. The low end is really emphasized. You know, it's very much about bass response and very much about dynamics in the higher end and the mid-range. So it's music that's made to sound really good on a big sound. And to that end, vinyl is really, you know, the medium that is the most kind of widely appreciated. And that's not to say that a lot of this music doesn't come out digitally too, but we chose to focus on, you know, strictly vinyl and stuff from the kind of dub spectrum. So some of it is more traditional, kind of roots-oriented dub music. Some of it is more, you know, purely electronic and more, you know, kind of future bass-oriented, and then everything in between.
How accessible is this to laymen? I mean, when I hear you say how you describe how the music is created, that seems to me that there can be people all over the world making this music without having to have budgets of multi-million dollar studios and the like.
Absolutely, absolutely. And music technology has evolved to the point where it's much more democratic than it was in the past. And we work with producers that come from all over the world, and that's an amazing and beautiful thing. Croatia, Finland, Denmark, mm-hmm. the United Kingdom, Germany, the United States, and as well as Turkey or mm-hmm. Algeria, mm-hmm. And Senegal.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know. Now, I heard you mention that you guys focus and specialize in 7 inches. Those are obviously LPs. Those require different kind of packaging than your normal CD does. They're singles. So can you talk to me about that process? That seems to be, you know, it's a tangible, physical thing that we can look and touch at. How have you pioneered or made a special place for that aspect of your production?
Well, I definitely can't say that we pioneered anything, because our approach definitely comes from a lot of different places, but the kind of punk rock DIY, you know, doing it absolutely yourself. You know, you could do it cheaper yourself, sometimes not as well, but if you're handling it yourself, you're not paying anybody else to do it. So hopefully everybody else in the chain, the artists, the musicians especially, get paid. But
that was the original DIY
yeah,
impulse, right?
Exactly.
I don't think you're saying that we do it more poorly and cheaper so that we can pay the artists more. Because that's the other thing. You can do it better and way more expensively in a DIY mode, too.
Right.
And the way we do it is definitely not always a time saver or
no,
money saver by any means.
No, but it's also a reaction to a kind of digital culture where, you know, people feel free to download music for free, sort of gobble it up, and then forget about it. But we're not interested in that. We're interested in making something that lasts and that people can hang on to. And we're interested in making these actual physical records that then get sleeved up into something that I've designed and I've printed by hand that matters, and it has meaning. And hopefully it adds meaning and value to the music that we're putting out. And it's super considered, and like as you're saying, there's a lot of time that goes into it.
It's really as much of an art project, like a collaborative art project between us, as it is a mm-hmm. a record label or a commercial venture.
Right.
You know.
Right. Right. So, if you don't mind me asking, how do you think your personal worldviews has impacted what resonates with you? I mean, you, like obviously being a label, you're getting lots of opportunities to listen to a lot of things, but obviously you're making some editorial selections. Where is that coming from? You know, when someone hears about Zam Sam, you know, granted, you can never know exactly what's in the heart of anybody in particular, but what kind of impact do you think your worldview is having on your selection process?
That's a deep question. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is just that we, you know, the reason that, I mean, I got into reggae when I was 14, staying at my cousin's place in the suburbs of Paris, and just listening to all his tapes, you know, Bob Marley tapes and Peter Tosh tapes, and that just changed my world, you know, and kind of politicized me and gave me kind of an ethical and moral orientation, you know, in terms of how to think about things that were going on in the world. And for me, you know, then that led to punk rock, and that led to rap and hip hop, and everything else. But that, so there was that initial like grounding in roots music, message music, you know, spiritual music. So even though a lot of what we release is instrumental, I still think of it as message music, as music that is, you know, that just kind of takes a stand against against irony, you know, against cynicism, against sarcasm, mm-hmm. against, you know, cleverness for its own sake, and is more about, like, you know, unity and community and, like, well, reality.
And being able to feel something and be earnest and have that be sufficient, you know, mm-hmm. that we don't need to critique ourselves on top of that. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be, yeah, terrible or cool. cynical.
Right. Mm-hmm. And not to get too technical, and my question is going to jump all over the place. How is your distribution model reaching people in this digital age? I mean, I have to admit, right now I've got a small phone that's basically a computer, and I can push a button and I can hear a variety of music in a variety of genres. Mm-hmm. But I can't do that with an LP. Mm-hmm. How do people find your work, and how do you reach out to people who might be interested in your work?
It's really a lot of social media. I mean, Tracy mm-hmm. recently designed us a beautiful and very functional website. But I think the reality right now is that Facebook and Instagram, you know, is word of mouth. Like, it's all word of mouth, and most word of mouth is virtual and digital now. So we definitely rely on those, you know, those platforms to get the word out.
But I think that built into this specific type of music that we're dealing with is the idea and the value in a record. That's just built into that music. Mm-hmm. And even though the physical record industry, you know, took a deep, deep dive, people are coming back around, obviously, in the last number of years. Lots and lots more vinyl sales. So I think those things together make it it's a more realistic venture to put all these records out there and expect people to buy them, you know. When we were on hiatus from record labels, it was a really hard time for people. But I think the tide has turned a little bit in favor of people wanting to spend their money on something that's not just a digital file.
Mm-hmm. Right. You mentioned that you guys are both DJs. Where have you traveled to in your journey, and how has that travel impacted the music that you play?
Wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've both spent quite a bit of time in Europe. We went to Turkey a lot of years ago, and I've been back a few times since, and it looks like we're going again in March.
Nice.
And we expect to have a couple gigs in Istanbul during that time.
Well, we've also been to Egypt. Mm-hmm. We also traveled through the Balkans in the mid 90s. We've traveled a lot together. Mm-hmm. We've traveled to the UK together since having this label, and you know that's where a lot of this music is really, really popular in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
The reason why I asked is that I'll admit, you know, whenever I think about DJs traveling and assembling, I imagine there's a lot of vinyl trading hands.
Mm-hmm. Always.
Yeah. And could you describe, you know, that process or that environment? I mean, when you go somewhere, it's not just to play, but it's also to listen.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we were just in New York at the end of May. And, you know, it's P.S. It's hard for us to both be in the same place at the same time because we have a young kid together. So doing all this, like, late night music stuff can be kind of challenging, but thankfully we have family that support us in that. But so we had this magical adventure to New York where we were both able to go, and we got to meet a lot of these people from the UK. They were there playing.
People that are on our label,
right?
Nice, you know, that we've never met face to face. So it was.
But so we were able to do exactly that. Give hand records to people that we're working with and hear them play and have this really incredible, meaningful experience. Like, mm-hmm. we're all enjoying this together. We're all supporters and makers.
Right.
And we're doing this together.
And even hand cash money to artists, which is a great feeling as an artist, you know, to be able to pay another artist first.
Right. Right. And that, I have to admit, I love to hear you say that, because obviously, I know that I can imagine in this music industry, you've got a lot of people that are handing money to people that aren't artists themselves.
Right. You know, almost all of it.
Exactly. I'm a businessman. I got my MBA from Tufts, and here's what I'm about. So listen, before we switch things up, I'd love to share some of your music with our audience. Can you help me set up this track that we're going to play next?
Yeah, so this is probably one of the rootsier tunes that you might hear on Zam Zam, from a Croatian producer called Igolis and a Senegalese vocalist called Daba Makuraja, a collaboration that we released earlier this year. Tune's called Yermende, it means compassion, right?
Oh, we could always use a little bit more of that, yeah. Couldn't we? That was dope. So how has the roots dub scene evolved, not just in Portland, but around the world? I mean, obviously, that young lady, that artist, isn't from Portland.
No.
Right. Not that she couldn't be. I mean, granted, mm-hmm. there's some people moving here. I know there's a vibrant community of people from around the mm-hmm. world. But how has the scene evolved in your experience?
I think sound system culture has gone worldwide. I think, you know, the UK is definitely still kind of the epicenter. But I think the worldwide explosion of sound system culture the last maybe 10 years or so has really created a lot of new audiences and a new openness. You know, the much maligned genre of dubstep and other kinds of like EDM and festival culture, like there's actually been a lot of openness created by those cultures and those arenas, you know.
Right.
So it's like a lot of those producers are very conscious of the influence of reggae and dub on their music, and that's gotten their audiences open to genres that they probably wouldn't have been available to before, you know. Like,
that's true.
Yeah.
Right. Nice. This is going to be, we're going a little deep here. Up until the 21st century, I think culture and the arts of indigenous or so-called third world people has all been ignored or discounted by the West and so-called first world cultures. I think the root of this dismissal is that arts and culture for many people of color back in the day was not meant to be commercialized. You know, it was a sharing of stories. It was how culture was passed down. It was meant to teach. It was shared to become a legacy. How does Zam Zam Sounds continue in that frame of reference?
That's a tough one, because I mean, you know, I don't want to reach too far and, you know, try to frame what we're doing as something that's in an indigenous mode, you know what I mean? Because it's definitely, as much as we feel that it's an art project and we really put our hearts and souls into it and we try to treat the artists right, at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's still a commercial venture. You know, we're still involved in this capitalist system as much as we would prefer to have some other way of doing it. So I also wonder about, you know, I mean, I agree that in most pre-20th century indigenous cultures, it doesn't seem like a stretch to say that it wasn't about commercialization. But the artists definitely had a role to play in society, and there, you know, there was some kind of exchange going on in terms of livelihood and being able to support yourself as
and
a
value.
Working artist.
And value.
So, yeah.
And value. I guess, you know, the reason why I brought up the subject, because it occurred to me that when I go and see pop culture, whether it's a symphony or a movie, the frame of reference is from a Western European background. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Our state, our society has, you know, the pops at, you know, Kennedy Center, and it's from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Whereas occurred to me, gosh, wouldn't it be amazing if the music of the Caribbean or of dances of Laotians or whoever, if that was the framework, if that was the basic DNA construct, you know, the basic ingredients of what we consider to be art. And I see that the work that you guys are putting out is shifting that perspective where people say, wow, this is not only commercially viable because they're making a living at it and they're sharing it, but it's just shifting the perspective, not, you know, to a different place, to a different peoples.
Well, I think that, you know, sound system culture comes from Jamaica. It was born there. And so everything that comes from it owes a debt to that.
Right.
And I think there are plenty of producers, performers out there who are not interested in that. But that's one thing that we've tried to stay true to that, and recognize that that's where this comes from. And it's important to remember that. It doesn't always have to sound exactly the same, but bearing that in mind as you move forward with, you know, the music that's coming out and the art that everything's packaged in, there are references, and hopefully those references are respectful and, you know, maintaining integrity.
Right.
And I agree too, in terms of the scene, it is much more about kind of community scale. You know, that's what you were saying made me flash on the origin, what you were saying also, Tracy, the roots of sound system culture. I mean, that's kind of the measure of success of a release in this scene, is like, what does it do in the dance, you know, and not a giant arena like you were talking about, not like the spectacle, but like a couple few hundred people.
How does it,
with a serious sound system in that moment, what kind of community does it create right there?
Right.
And then, you know, like, is it uplifting? Is it like bringing people together?
Are people feeling it at all?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, is the bass doing what it needs to do, you know, in the service of creating unity? Like, so yeah, I guess in that sense, it does connect back maybe to some more community-based traditions. Like,
yeah. And essentially, put it that way, because my daughter can hit a button and she's listening to a popular artist, and there could be a million people around the world listening at the same time. But now that you mention it, I love the concept or the model of a level of intimacy in a shared experience. And obviously, this music was designed not necessarily be heard through headphones, which is great, but it was designed to be heard in a venue,
right,
with people moving, with people bumping into each other and interacting and seeing across the room. And I think that that does speak back to a certain, dare I say, third world indigenous community sense, where, you know, hey, let's get some speakers together. We're going to take over that little, that little shanty over there, or take over that little square, and we're going to do this for us. And yeah, we might have a vendor who's going to sell some food. We might have someone who's do some drink going around.
Right.
But, you know, there was not to say there wasn't aspiration, but it was okay for something to be about the community, about the people.
Right.
Well, and it's okay for the expectation for whatever that is to be limited, you know, and to not be this ever expanding model of like, well, it's got to be bigger next time. It's got to be bigger next time. It can just be that.
Right. I mean, in this scene, if you sell 1,000 copies of a release on vinyl, like, that's huge, you
right
know? It's
right.
So and it's an international scene, so it's very diffuse, it's very dispersed, and that's another reason I think it's so fascinating to be doing this right now, is it's very much about that community thing we're talking about, and the community is worldwide. So even in the mixing of the music, you've got to mix it for sounds, but you also have to mix it in such a way that, as you said, it will sound decent on computer speakers or headphones, because the reality is that's how we're connecting with most of the people, at least initially, till they get the record.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense.
It's interesting.
So to flip things around a little bit more, you guys have both worked with refugee populations, haven't you?
I have.
I haven't, not in a professional capacity.
Right.
You know, some of my favorite people are refugees.
There you go. I, and that falls, I mean,
definitely,
follow up.
And immigrants.
Like, one could easily say that the current construct that is America was founded by refugees. And it's also easy to say that the contributions of a wide assortment of so-called refugees and immigrants have made this country what it is today. How does the music that you're selecting help further the idea and the notion that this entire planet is a mosaic, mm-hmm. that we are not just a collection of individual nation states that are constantly fighting and vying for resources. How does your music start to bridge some of those gaps between people?
I think part of it comes down to, you know, when you hear the music and the dance, you know, who is there? So many people are there, whether you're, you know, in the United Kingdom, you're in New York, you might be in Portland, you might be in France, you might be in Istanbul or in Bosnia. Mm. People are going out to these dances, they're building sound systems, they're playing this music, and people are coming from all these different communities to go do that together. I think that's really important. And the idea of community around music, whether it's a really huge genre or a really small genre like this, it's very meaningful. It is deeply meaningful. And that's what it comes down to for me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Nice.
And I think the label itself, too, as a curated body of work, you know, we really want to bring in producers from all over the world, and bands and artists and vocalists and, you know, players of instruments. Like, the more international it can be, the better as far as we're concerned, because that is a way of breaking down more walls too, you know. And I feel like, in a way, you know, we also get to be ambassadors of a less awful American culture, you know, the fact that, you know, the music comes to us and then we disseminate it. That feels good too. It feels like a little bit of an antidote. Like, you know, I know now there are some people, you know, in sound system culture and other places that are like, okay, Americans aren't all effed up, you know? I mean, not that we don't have our own issues, Tracy and I individually and personally, but it does feel like an antidote to the hegemonic, mm-hmm. you know, American culture that most people not in the U.S., are on the receiving end of in one way
right.
or another.
Right.
I mean, yeah, no one's got the monopoly on good ideas. It's not us, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So more people contributing good ideas, the better. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter. Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it seems that sometimes there's monopoly on how those good ideas get disseminated.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know? So share with me, what are you guys working on? What's next in the pipeline? Anything new you'd like to share yes. with our audience? Please share.
Wow. Well, yeah, so this is late breaking news to us. We are planning on going to Istanbul in March, so hopefully we'll connect with some artists there and, you know, do a dance or two. Loads of releases on the way. A 12-inch by a Bristol, UK producer called P-Man is coming out in a couple weeks.
Yeah, just a couple weeks.
A bunch of incredible remixes of myself, E3, and Alter Echo. Coming out on 10-inch vinyl in January.
Then after that, you know, probably a couple of 7-inches at a time for the foreseeable few months. We have a lot coming out.
Yeah, we've got right. releases. The queue is pretty much like a year and a half out at this point in terms nice. Of stuff we've either got pressing or just commitments that right. we've made. So
now, you mentioned the website, but you didn't mention the website. So how can people find you guys and find access to your catalog?
ZamZamSounds.com.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty simple.
It's yeah. pretty simple. Forget
ZamZam Sounds on Instagram, ZamZam Sounds on Facebook.
Right. Well, listen, I want to thank you guys both for coming today. It was amazing talking to you. You know, much love. I really appreciate you sharing your music with me and our entire audience.
Thank you, Andre.
Same, man. Thank you for having us.
So we're going to, I want to thank everybody. This is especially our engineer, Janet Anderson, and all the KBU volunteers and staff that make this program possible. And especially a big, big ups and thank yous to my guests, Ezra and Tracy from ZamZam Sounds. You can find photos and links and information about our guest on our show page at KBU FM Art Focus. Please follow the link to our Facebook and like our KBU Art Focus page on Facebook. If you missed today's show, there will be a podcast of the show online later today. I'll be running a pre-recorded show next week where I'll be interviewing some local folks that are producing a comedy showcase music extravaganza. Benefit for the Freemason Lodge for St. Joseph's on North Mississippi Avenue. It's my goal to meet and introduce the listeners of KBU to a broad spectrum of regional artists. If you're a visual artist in any medium, I'd love to have you or your organization on the show. It's also my goal to share information relevant to artists as well. When I learn about residencies, grants, deadlines, call for artists, you'll hear about it in this show as well as on our Facebook page, KBU Art Focus. We're going out with the music from Danny Skrilla from Portland's own Zam Zam Sounds. Thank you again for joining us on Art Focus, KBU Radio, Portland, Oregon. Take care and peace.
Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBU.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBU's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBU members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBU.
Thank you.